Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget the IRS, everybody. We got the tax man right here, Congressman Dave Camp, and the Tax Reform Act of 2014 coming up from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 26th of February. And the document in question is 979 pages long. It's been in the works for going on 3 years, and yet it may not actually go too much further, at least not right now, because tax reform is just hard, you know? Congressman Dave Camp is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. It is his bill we are talking about. Congressman, it's good to have you on.
Kai, good to be with you.
Got to ask how your day is going, sir. Both the Speaker of the House and Senator McConnell in the last 24 hours have pretty much kneecapped this plan. They said it's not coming for a vote. Fine to talk about it. How you feeling about that?
Look, I think we can't wait. We can't settle for an economy that isn't growing. We can't settle for 2% growth. We can't settle for the fact that we don't create enough jobs for kids to get out and get on their own. They're having to live with their parents. We've had median incomes declining for the last several years. Pro-growth tax reform is one of those things that will actually turn our economy around. This bill has been scored by a nonpartisan referees who analyze our legislation, is actually increasing our GDP by 20%, creating almost 2 million jobs. So it's absolutely critical that we move forward.
I'm going to drill down a little bit then, Congressman, and get your take on some of the specifics in this thing. First of all, you want to reduce tax brackets from 7 down to 2. You want two tax rates, 10% and 25%. Help me understand how that's going to work and not increase the deficit on this thing.
Well, right now the top tax rate for individuals is 39.6, and for businesses is 35. We have the highest corporate rate in the world. So absolutely reducing those rates is very important. That also simplifies our code. Instead of 7 brackets, we're down to 2. That's very important to do for individuals. And what we do is we take a reform of the code and the dollars that come from that reform. We then plow back into lowering tax rates.
I don't quite understand what that means. I didn't hear you say anything specific there, sir, as to how you're going to cut loopholes or do any of those things.
Well, that's why I've released a detailed bill today. There are 228 provisions that we eliminate in the tax code. For example, one of the areas that we address is how people save for their retirement through IRAs. About 5% of employees contribute over $8,000. A year to their IRA. To those who do that, we say anything over $8,000 has to go to a Roth IRA, and that's one of the changes we make that actually helps us lower rates.
You do want to increase some taxes, and I realize that's a loaded phrase, so you can frame it how you like, but you want to, for example, tax some big banks. It's a small percentage tax, really, really small. How is that going to fly, you taxing big banks?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to understand that every corporation is going to have their rate reduced from 35 to 25. That's a 30% reduction. The financial sector doesn't have a lot of other trade-offs to make. They actually pay pretty much at a 35% rate. And so what we're doing in order to lower rates is we're saying this is going to be a revenue-neutral bill. We're not going to increase the size of the deficit with it. So the financial community has an obligation to step up so that we can lower rates and grow the economy for all of America.
You propose a surtax on the very wealthy, over $400,000 for single filers. What kind of pushback have you gotten on that?
Well, 99% of Americans will pay the highest rate will be 25%. And my view is if you can have 99% of Americans paying a rate, that is the rate. And when I was in school, 99% was an A.
It was a passing grade. With all respect, sir, if it's so great, and I, you know, you're entitled to your opinion, but if it's so great, why doesn't anybody seem to like it? I got emails this morning before this plan was even out, clobbering it.
Well, I've had a lot of good support for it. You're going to see a lot of both individuals, businesses, associations, organizations come out in favor of it. And I think it's important that we have this debate.
If this thing passes in 2 years after you've left the chairmanship, are you going to tear your hair out? You're going to be all right.
Look, I am not going to concede that it's going to take that long, but we need to move the debate forward. We need to get on the field. We need to move the ball down the field. And, you know, when you start moving the ball down the field, you never know when you're going to score. If the score is sooner, that's fine. If the score is in 2 years from now, that's fine, too.
Congressman Dave Camp, Republican of Michigan, Chairman of the House Committee on Ways and Means. Congressman, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thanks much, Kai.
They were moving the ball on Wall Street today. Not a whole lot, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Target reported quarterly profits today, the first time it's opened its books since the great data breach of 2013. Best guesses are as many as 70 million people had their personal data compromised between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So, as you might expect, earnings were down, way down, off 46%, in fact. And as to the data breach itself, Target says it's cost the company about $60 million, although the retailer was quick to point out that when all is said and done, the $60 million will be more like $17 million. Because Target, like more and more companies these days, has something called cyber insurance. Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
This type of coverage is not new.
I was involved in the first policies that were developed back in 1999.
Emily Freeman is a cyber risk specialist for Lockton. That's a global insurance firm. She says demand for these policies is up.
We're getting calls every day from companies that want to buy cyber insurance to protect themselves.
A policy could cover civil penalties and legal fees. Policies also pay for forensic investigations. Scott Gottes is a lawyer with Barnes and Thornburg who focuses on corporate insurance. And he says that after a data breach, there are lots of questions.
Are there people that are in your system? When did they get in there? Are they still in there? And how do we get them out?
It costs a lot to answer those questions. Tyler Moore is a computer science professor at Southern Methodist University. He says cyber insurance can take care of the costs of notifying customers and giving them credit protection.
Just generally needing to clean up the mess that's been created.
But these policies have limits, he says.
The reputational damage to a company following a high-profile breach, for instance, is not typically covered.
Companies don't like to advertise what kind of coverage they have. Today, Target said its insurance helped offset costs, but it did not go into detail. Lockton's Emily Freeman says it's important to remember cyber insurance is meant to be a backstop for companies.
We sit on the shoulders of their best efforts to prevent the event from happening in the first place.
As insurers draft policies, they want to know companies are doing all they can, that they're investing heavily in security. Because after all, when that security fails, it's the insurers who will have to pay. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In that glorious way that capitalism has, by the way, we should tell you that Target stock today was up 7%. Congress gets a pretty bad rap for how few bills actually get passed. But just because bills aren't passing doesn't mean bills aren't being filed. You know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands are proposed every year. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to have a look at what all that wheel spinning is costing us.
Last year, almost 6,000 bills were introduced in Congress. Only 56 were passed by both houses and signed into law by the president. Sometimes lawmakers introduce legislation they know is a dead end, according to Scott Adler, who teaches political science at the University of Colorado.
And they're just simply making a statement or taking a political position on an issue with no real possibility that the legislation is going to go anywhere.
Adler says politicians are trying to show they're doing something on issues important to voters, campaign donors, or interest groups like Taxpayers for Common Sense, whose vice president, Steve Ellis, says a bill can serve as a rallying point and it's worth the cost, even if it never becomes law.
If it costs a little bit, and I know I'm a budget watchdog, but also I care about civics and democracy.
Ellis says there's no way to quantify the cost of these dead-end bills, but he says it's not much. Most congressional staffers don't get overtime. And how about this for a money saver? Sometimes lobbyists write bills. Lee Drutman is with the Sunlight Foundation.
The language is given to overworked congressional staffs. Rarely do members even read the bills that they introduce.
Okay, then. Well, I guess that saves time. And if time is money, in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Law Los Angeles International Airport is in the thick of a billion-dollar makeover. New stores, newly renovated spaces, all the usual fun fixer-upper things. But a big piece of the project is something a little bit less sexy. Good signage. A low-tech discipline in a high-tech world, as Alex Schmidt reports.
LAX may be a major hub, but there's no easy way to get from terminal to terminal. And don't expect much help from the airport's signs. Laura Valdez lives in San Francisco and often flies through LAX.
At times, I've had to navigate that myself, and the signage and the instructions on how to get there isn't very useful, and that has, you know, caused me to miss flights.
The airport is spending more than $800,000 on wayfinding. Essentially, wayfinding is the signage system that helps you get around a city, a museum, a hospital, or an airport.
We think in good wayfinding, a visitor can feel confident going that direction because they're going to have a nice friendly sign.
That's Wayne Hunt. His wayfinding design firm just won the project for LAX. A few years back, Hunt's company redesigned the signage of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. They got rid of hundreds of mismatched and confusing signs. Now there's a system of sleek granite pylons with simple illustrations that anyone can follow.
We created 35 simplified pictograms or icons, one for each of the main destinations. Once you recognize the system, you can follow U.S. Capitol icon around the mall and get to the U.S. Capitol.
Hunt says now's a good time to be in the signage business. Hundreds of cities and public agencies are investing in new signs. Hunt says that's because it's a relatively cheap way to make an impact.
You're not building any buildings, you're not moving any roads, and yet it gives us a sense there's lots to do.
But hang on, it's 2014 and we're talking physical signs? There's got to be an app for that. Well, there is. Jeff Hardison is a vice president of Meridian, a digital wayfinding software platform. The company has created apps for the American Museum of Natural History and the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas. Hardison says mobile phones are just one of many digital options that will challenge traditional signage.
It could be in Google Glass, it could be in digital signage, it could be in augmented reality, or it could simply be in a map that you're very familiar with using on the phone.
Last year, a large Wi-Fi network company bought Meridian for over $20 million. Hardison says if traditional sign companies don't adapt to digital options, they could disappear. But the real-world sign still has a few things going for it. Imagine having to take out a smartphone to find your way around a hospital emergency department. And not everyone has a smartphone. Back at LAX, a traveler named Bill got lost coming out of customs. He says a makeover would help the airport compete on a world stage.
Have you ever seen Dubai Airport?
No.
It's fabulous. The signs are very clear. It makes this look like a small regional airport.
Bill says new signs will make a difference, but he also wouldn't mind a wayfinding app to help him get around LAX. In Los Angeles, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
Coming up.
She was fierce, and many times her drawing pen was her weapon.
Fighting racism with cartoons. But first, let's do the numbers. Shares ended slightly higher today. The Dow Industrials lifted 18 points, about a 10%, closed at 16,198, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ hiked 4 points, a 10%, ended things at 4,292. The S&P 500 traded flat, 1845 there. Pretty much everybody associated with the housing market got a lift today on news that new home sales hit a 5.5-year high in January. Toll Brothers bricked up 1.75%. Pulte Homes nailed a 2.8% gain. Construction retailer Lowe's Companies stepped 5% higher after it reported stronger earnings. And Home Depot rose just shy of 1% today. Chesapeake Energy, though, reported a net loss and fell almost 5%. First Solar also reported lower earnings, slid 9%. Their Dollar Tree, though, climbed 5% after the company gave a positive outlook for the year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury notes rose to 2.66%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, a Senate committee discusses promoting college access and success for students with disabilities. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods for January. Maybe you got yourself an appliance you didn't get for Christmas. And feeling a little cold? Winter getting you down? Well, bring on the heat. Tomorrow is National Chili Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Cold War will be back in the middle of public debate in the UK next week. Lawmakers there will be talking about that country's nuclear veterans, the thousands of servicemen who witnessed British and joint US-UK atmospheric nuclear tests. Many of those men went on to develop serious health problems. The US agreed to compensate its nuclear veterans back in the 1980s, but the Brits are still holding out, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
21,000 British servicemen took part in the testing. Many were ordered to witness the series of thermonuclear explosions like this one on Christmas Island in April 1958.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, plus one, you may turn now.
Standing out in the open, many dressed only in T-shirts and shorts, the men were told to turn their backs and put their hands in front of their faces.
There's a huge flash, and you can see the bones of your hands. The flash goes through your body, and you can see the bones of your hands, like an X-ray.
Don James, 19 years old at the time, believes that he and his fellow soldiers were standing about 5 miles from where the bomb was detonated.
Did you feel the force of the explosion?
Yes. As if somebody's opening an oven and the heat you can feel on your back. And then you get the blast come in and some of the coconut trees were bent right down, touching the ground.
Britain fires its first H-bomb to join the United States.
Don James believes the men were there to witness the explosions so the scientists could study their reactions, even though, as this newsreel of the day makes clear, there were concerns about radiation.
But the test added heat to the mounting debate over the safety of atomic tests.
Many of the young servicemen who played a part in the testing later developed severe health problems, among them Jeff Lydiat.
At one stage, I was in a wheelchair. I do find walking very difficult now. I can't walk very far. And I'm in constant pain. I take painkillers every day.
Like many of the nuclear veterans, Jeff suffers from a degenerative bone disease.
You believe there is a link between the nuclear tests and your health problems?
Yes. Well, the radiologists who've looked at my bones have said that my symptoms are very similar to the people who worked in X-ray right at the beginning.
But the British government and the courts do not accept there is a causal link between the tests and the veterans' ill health. They've refused to pay any compensation. Unlike the US, Washington has set aside more than $130 million to support American nuclear test veterans. John Barron is a member of the British Parliament.
The Americans treat their veterans much more generously. You do not have to prove a causal link. All you have to show is that you were there and you suffer one of a number of illnesses and you then get compensation.
And he points out that France too has awarded its nuclear vets on average more than $75,000 each.
What we're basically saying is that Britain ranks towards the bottom of the international table of decency, as we call it.
The UK government is clearly worried about cost. The incidence of birth defects among the veterans' children is disproportionately high. Shelley Grigg is a veteran's daughter with a host of debilitating congenital ailments. She says the government is terrified of a financial chain reaction.
They're frightened of how much money they're going to have to pay out, not only to the veterans, but their children and their children and their children. It's like a family tree. Where does it end? And where would they stop paying out money? It would just be too expensive for them.
But as the newsreels at the time dramatically declared, the nuclear tests played a vital part in the defence of Europe. Campaigners claim that Britain owes a debt of honour to those who contributed to Britain's nuclear deterrent.
For it seems that by the possession of such deadly weapons, peace can be maintained in this troubled world.
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations has been working all day today, holding hearings in which executives from Credit Suisse have been on the hot seat. Investigators say the bank helped Americans evade taxes and hide their money in Swiss bank accounts. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that that hiding involves some pretty sly maneuvering.
The first step of hiding money is usually moving money.
People tried to move money around without being detected.
Allison Murphy is a counsel with the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Murphy says almost all business would be done in person, no ATMs or paper trails. In one case, someone reportedly hid $250,000 in their pantyhose. Security was, of course, a top priority. Murphy's office talked to one tax evader in particular.
He would be escorted into a plain elevator with no buttons. The elevator would be controlled remotely.
And all paper that could be shredded was shredded. There was also a Credit Suisse branch in the Zurich airport with 9,000 accounts.
Americans traveling to Switzerland to go skiing, for example, would be so much easier for them to just go to the airport to conduct their banking business.
But Murphy says the big money was moved around in a much less sexy way, the old-fashioned fake shell company. Rob Wood is a tax attorney with Wood LLP. He says anyone who has lived or worked abroad and has foreign bank accounts can end up paying if they haven't been filing taxes.
You pay the taxes that you should have paid at the time, plus interest, and plus a 20% penalty, plus a penalty that comes at the very end of the case, 27.5% of the offshore account balance.
And did I mention that's what you pay if you turn yourself in? If you don't, the fines can be much higher and you can go to jail. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are people in every business, in every industry that, and I know this is going to sound basic, but they simply change the way things are done, and they do it on a really big scale. That's the premise of the series we started a couple of days ago called The Innovators. And this week, to close out Black History Month, African-American innovators, and a woman named Jackie Orms, an African-American political cartoonist more than a half a century ago. Here's her biographer, Nancy Goldstein.
People often ask me, well, you know, what made Jackie Orms so unique? What was original about her? What did she bring in that was new? Well, first of all, here comes a 5'2", all of 105-pound little lady into a newsroom full of men at a time when women really were not even in the newspapers that much, but certainly were not cartoonists. What she brought was lead characters who were female. They were intelligent, they were sophisticated and witty and sometimes brave. They were shopping, they were going to concerts, taking music lessons, going on road trips, really living the upscale life in a way that defied those stereotypes and caricatures of blacks that you see in the comics that were in the mainstream press. But underneath, she often had protest and satire. She was fierce. And many times her drawing pen was her weapon. She took on racism, taxes, and labor strikes, McCarthyism, United States foreign policy, the Cold War, education, housing, and jobs. She was the first cartoonist of any kind to bring out environmental pollution. In one particular episode, she shows how the water is befouled by the drainage from the factory and how the air is full of smoke and soot. Talk about contemporary. In 1985, a reporter interviewed Jackie Orms, and she said to him, "I'm just so surprised that people remember me." It took about 30 years for another African-American cartoonist woman to come along.
Nancy Goldstein's biography of Jackie Orms is called Jackie Orms, the first African-American woman cartoonist. You can see some of the cartoons and hear all the pieces in our series, The Innovators, at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, NASA has announced the discovery of 715 new planets, 715 of them. As a point of comparison, we'd only identified about 1,000 before that, that is, since like Galileo, practically. They were all found using the new $600 million Kepler telescope, and NASA says there are probably more to come. One of the new ones is about twice the size of Earth, and four of the planets are in what NASA calls the habitable zone, meaning they can support life, which would be cool. And also this, a note in which any chance I ever had for getting an upgrade while flying Delta goes straight out the window. The company announced a big change to its frequent flyer program today, starting next year. It's all about how much you spend, not how far you fly. And I get it. It's a business dog-eat-dog world. Yes, got to make money. Going after all the free-spending business travelers, not the cost-conscious personal flyers. But come on, nothing at long last. Do we get nothing for our flying troubles anymore? All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.